incredibly diverse city that things happen here. They often lead the rest of the country in terms of policy and some of the challenges that the city faces. We need to obviously continue to cover that aggressively, as well as the state. I mean, we are the voice of the state. So just making sure we're running on all cylinders and making sure that we have the platforms, using the platforms to broadcast that, you know, as widely as possible.
Jim Kirk on Press Play last August when he became interim executive editor for the Los Angeles Times. Then Louis Dvorkin took over in October, and now Dvorkin is out and Kirk is back, this time permanently. Well, maybe. There doesn't seem to be a lot of permanence these days on the LA Times masthead. Turmoil in the nation's second largest newsroom seems to be the norm. Gabriel Kahn teaches journalism at USC Annenberg. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Okay, so Jim Kirk, he's a veteran of the Chicago Sun-Times, a veteran of Tronc, I guess, the company that runs these papers. Tell us about his background and what he's going to do at the LA Times.
So on the latter, I really don't know, and I'm eager to find out. On the former, you know, he's been a journalist in Chicago for quite some time, has worked at pretty much every major publication in that city. And since he joined Tronc, he's been used as sort of a utility infielder by the company to kind of fill in when they've had a vacancy at top editorial spots, first at the LA Times, then at the Daily News. But now he's been brought back to the LA Times as the no longer interim editor, but as the editor-in-chief.
Okay, so just to bring us up to speed, it's been quite a momentous last few weeks at the Los Angeles Times. Can you just go over what's happened in the newsroom?
Oh, gosh. Okay, so let's start with last August. The longtime editor, Devon Maharaj, was fired when it became clear to management that that the newsroom really did not work well with him. That was when Kirk was brought in. Then they did what was supposed to be a nationwide search, and they hired this guy named Louis Dvorkin, who came in just about 2 months ago. Dvorkin lost the trust of the newsroom pretty much within the first week when he negotiated a kind of truce with Disney, which had blocked out the LA Times from coverage, from movie previews and things like that. And he basically patched that up, but did not really disclose to the newsroom if anything had happened, if there was any sort of quid pro quo, raising a lot of suspicions. Then after that, it's been kind of dumpster fire after dumpster fire. Last week, the business editor was essentially escorted out of the office with no explanation. She wasn't even allowed to turn off her computer. And the suspicion was that she was suspected of speaking to other press outlets about the problems at the LA Times. That was just sort of one episode of just this kind of culture of suspicion that has come about. Not irrelevant to this is the fact that the newsroom just voted overwhelmingly to unionize for the first time ever at the paper. And that's more than just a footnote, because now this is a very much empowered newsroom union that really wants to have an active say in what's going on.
Right. And meanwhile, they're saying that the company is trying to create this shadow newsroom, hiring these people, not telling the staffers what they're doing there. And their suspicions are that they're trying to break the union.
Absolutely. And we didn't even talk about how the publisher was suspended on until they can further review some sexual harassment settlements that he made recently. So it's just there's a fire to put out in every corner, everywhere you look. But what you just mentioned is, you know, was supposedly part of this somewhat secret plan to relaunch the paper, to do so with a shadow newsroom, again, as you mentioned, that's not unionized, that was going to be in the same building, that was going to sort of be part of this pyramid structure of some paid and some unpaid contributors who were going to be, you know, filing stories that would be published under one of the Tronc brands in some fashion. Not a lot was known about it, but people had been hired. Those people had never been announced to the rest of the newsroom, and so it was sort of felt that it was being done in secret. And nobody knew what that was going to mean, what that was going to mean for the editorial process or the editorial integrity of the newspaper.
So some of the journalists actually found out who some of the people were. One of them was a respected journalist from The New York Times, Louise Story. Another one, Sylvester Monroe, who worked at The Washington Post, also at NPR. And, you know, still unclear what these people. I think Louise Story says she's not coming to the paper after all, but unclear what these other people are doing.
Yes, unclear, no clear communication about what the sort of general goal of all of this was, how it was going to work together. And of course, you do this just around the time that the union, that the newsroom has voted to form a union. They see this as essentially potentially scab labor. That only makes things more tense. And on top of that, you know, Louis Dvorkin never really kind of communicated or hung out with the staff of the newsroom. So just creating more distance there, and very quickly an incredibly adversarial relationship between staff and management.
Okay, so he isn't fired outright, or Dvorkin, he's sort of reassigned to Tronc as a content officer or something like that, right?
Yes, and so that also raises some, you know, concerns, because although the paper has a new editor, the one that they were very suspicious of hasn't gone away. He just has a new desk.
So what is the overall mission for Tronc? What is the vision for the LA Times?
Madeline, I wish I knew that. Now, we see this is in the last couple of years. You know, so first of all, the LA Times has changed ownership a number of times in the last decade. The current chairman of Tronc, Michael Farrow, hasn't really disclosed what he wants to do with the LA Times or the other papers that he owns, which include the Chicago Tribune and others. And, you know, this is odd because, of course, the entire industry is shifting so dramatically, and it is, you know, it is basically difficult enough to manage a newspaper right now anyway without all these self-inflicted wounds that the LA Times and Tronc appears to be, you know, stumbling across every 2 seconds. You know, this Michael Farrow is not your John Henry of the Boston Globe or your Jeff Bezos now of the Washington Post, in the sense that he hasn't really come to this with any kind of discussion of civic duty or obligation or anything like that. The way he talks about it is more as an asset that he's trying to extract the most value from.
Right. And so that is not necessarily compatible with good journalism.
Well, it can be if it's done in a with a sort of a long-term vision and with a shared vision that both the newsroom and the audience for the paper understand the value that they're putting forth on this, and it requires investment and some patience. We haven't seen any of that. We've seen, you know, concerns expressed in the newsroom when Michael Farrow was going to pay his consulting company $5 million out of Tronc coffers for consulting. You know, feeling that those are resources that certainly could be spent on the newsroom to improve the product. We also have, you know, initially when he took over, there were whisperings that they were going to roll out this giant kind of automated video creation machine that was going to create all of these news videos almost automatically using AI. That never came to fruition. So there hasn't really been any talk either about the financial direction of the company or the editorial direction of the company. And, you know, considering it's essentially a newspaper company, you have to have both of those conversations together.
Gabriel Kahn teaches journalism at USC Annenberg. Thanks, Gabe.
Thank you, Madeline.
Despite all the changes and troubles at the LA Times, the paper's newsroom continues to break stories, and some important ones, like the latest in the scandal involving USC's former medical school dean. Over the weekend, the Times reported that the LA County Sheriff's Department wants to talk with Carmen Pugliafito about the death of a 3-week-old boy back in October. Pugliafito made a 911 call.
Fire Department, I'm 26.
Hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Baby not breathing. Yes, baby not breathing.
Are you there at the location right now?
No, my girlfriend's there.
How old is this child, sir?
3 weeks.
Pugliafito was not the father of this child, but he was apparently having an affair with the mother, a young woman who was a drug addict and part of a group Pugliafito did drugs with. Harriet Ryan is an investigative reporter at the Times, and she co-wrote that story. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so first, who is this young woman, and why is she in this apartment, and why is Pugliafito involved in calling about this incident?
Dori Yoder is 27 years old. She moved to Los Angeles about a decade ago from Missouri. She was raised in Missouri and Pennsylvania in the Amish religion, and she, like many young people, had come to L.A. to sort of find fame, I guess, and she'd been a model and kind of like a party girl in Hollywood. And eventually she became a drug addict, and she was addicted to heroin, according to court records. and police records of an arrest last year. And she crossed paths with Carmen Pulifito, who was the dean of USC Medical School at the time, and became part of this kind of like large circle of drug addicts and criminals and prostitutes that this prominent physician and academic was associating with.
And she was actually having a relationship with him?
Yes, it's not entirely clear. She, as you mentioned, she had a child in September, and that child was the father of that child was another drug addict who was a member of this circle of party people. But Pulifito has described her as both his girlfriend and his mistress, and he was paying for her living expenses, as far as we know, and also rent at this apartment where the child died in Altadena.
And he was living in Pasadena, so nearby?
Yeah, he lives in a huge house. In Redfin, if you look, it's, I think, $7 million or $8 million house in Pasadena that was about a 10-minute, 15-minute drive from this apartment in a duplex she was living in Altadena.
So he makes this phone call, and then I guess the ambulance arrives and the baby's dead already?
Yes, we have some of the reports that the paramedics wrote, and they're heavily redacted, so we don't know exactly, you know, what they found and what they were told. We do know that the condition of the child when they arrived was such that they did not take him to the hospital or even begin CPR. He was not, in their judgment, there was no chance of resuscitating him. You know, it was a seemingly healthy child who died outside a hospital, so of course there's an immediate investigation by the coroner's office and the homicide bureau of the LA County Sheriff's Department.
And has there been any assessment as to how the baby died?
We don't know everything because initially the detective said, look, you know, the sheriff's department said, look, it could be an accident, natural causes or a crime. We're trying to get to the bottom of it. We don't have a cause of death. We're working with the coroner's office. And then earlier this month, they said that the toxicology screen had come back, which would show if there were any drugs in the baby's body, and that they, at the same time or about the same time, put a security hold on the coroner's report and the autopsy findings, which means the public at this time is not able to find out, you know, what the medical examiner thinks or if there's been any sort of finding how the child died.
But there is an investigation, a homicide investigation.
It's fair to say that after they got the toxicology screen back, the homicide detectives continued working on the case.
And so why do they want to talk to Pulifito? What could be his involvement in that?
What they've told us is that they don't consider him a suspect in any sort of crime, if there is one, related to the child's death. But they look at him as a possible witness or informant who could, you know, shed light on the situation. They've said that he could provide information about the parties involved in this investigation, the mother, the father, and they wanted to interview him. And through an attorney, he has said no.
But this isn't the first time that something like this has happened. You were part of the team that wrote about this woman, Sarah Warren, who was part of Pulifito's partying circle, who overdosed last year when Pulifito was actually with her. And you know, she had to go to the hospital. Can you talk about this pattern of, you know, near deaths, and then in this case, a death associated with Pulifito and his circle of drug addicts?
I mean, it's, you know, it's true that he was present at the scene of an overdose in March 2016, and that the police were called, and they ultimately did not arrest him or charge anybody in that incident. And, you know, this is a separate incident. Circumstances are very different, and there's no evidence at this time that Pulifito was present in the home when the baby died. There's no evidence that I know. I mean, the police have evidence, but I don't know it, whether they've reached a conclusion about whether this was a crime or not.
But at least the father of Dora Yoder, who's the mom of this infant who died, was concerned enough about her drug use and Pulifito's involvement that he called up the police and said that his daughter was getting drugs from Pulifito.
So this was in 2016, before Dora Yoder became pregnant. Her father, back in Missouri, had placed a call to the sheriff's station in Altadena because he and her mother could not locate her. And he'd said that, you know, he had concerns about an eye doctor who we've learned is Pulifito, and kind of laid out the situation to the deputy who answered the phone. And I've listened to that recording, and you can hear the deputy being like, what? Like, sort of trying to wrap his mind about around, like, exactly what they're alleging, and then saying, you know what, I'm going to send somebody out to the house to try to help you. And what we know is that either the family or deputies were able to locate her. They found her at a hotel in Pasadena where Polifido and his party crowd, you know, had frequently gone. And she was an adult. I mean, at that time, she was 25 or 26 years old. And, you know, they have a father saying, you know, her life is a mess. I don't think she should be hanging around with this doctor. But, you know, she's an adult. She makes her own choices. And so they didn't pursue any kind of charges or pursue the matter really at all.
So this latest story, this latest incident, the death of this three-week-old boy, this happened after you reported initially on Polifido, and it was a huge scandal.
Yes, and I know that when our story first came out in the summer, and a series of stories, we were told by various associates of the former dean that he was getting help for his problems. But what this incident with the baby shows is that the contact with this party circle continued, and that whether he went to treatment, I don't know, but he was continuing like a very frequent association with these people who had serious addiction problems.
And so what's happening with that? Is he being sued by those patients? Is he being investigated?
The state medical board, you know, has attempting to revoke or suspend his license. He surrendered it voluntarily this fall. I've never talked to anybody who has a complaint against Dr. Polifido as a physician. In fact, people that I have had heard from have said that he was a great eye doctor and they loved him. And as far as I know, there are no accusations against him for harming a patient when he was under the influence or at any other time. Some emails I've received have said, this is all terrible, but I just want you to know if he were your doctor, you would have loved him.
And what about USC? Are they investigating? And what is the fallout for the university?
So in the wake of our story last summer, they hired the law firm Gibson Dunn and former U.S. attorney Deb Yang to conduct an investigation into Polifido and how the university leadership responded to his issues. We were initially told that that report would be completed maybe around the end of the year. We are constantly asking USC, where is that report? When are we going to see it? Is the public going to see it? Is the USC community going to be told what the findings were? And I don't have any idea at this time.
Well, Harriet, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's Harriet Ryan. She's an investigative reporter at the LA Times. Coming up, how the Koch brothers plan to spend $400 million in this year's campaigns. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Big time donors on the Republican side. The Koch brothers hosted their semi-annual retreat this weekend just outside Palm Springs in Indian Wells. The Koch network has pledged to spend more than $400 million on midterm races this year. Meanwhile, BuzzFeed reports that some of President Trump's top political advisors may be skirting some campaign finance laws as they gear up for his re-election bid in 2020. It is Monday, which means Jessica Levinson is here to talk about all of this. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Legal Eagle. Hi there.
Hi there.
Well, let's start with the Kochs. $400 million, that seems like a not insubstantial amount of money. And it is more, I guess, than they spent in the last election. Why are they spending so much money this time around?
You sound like a lawyer. It is not insubstantial at all. So they have decided that, as they said this morning, this is going to be a bruising midterms. And it's interesting the way they describe this $400 million. They describe it as an investment. And I think that's exactly what it is. People spend money in elections because they think it can make a difference. And they're basically spending money to try and elect certain people because they see that as an investment and to increase their profits.
And certain people being congressional candidates in certain states, have they identified who they want to spend money on?
They're starting to identify who they want to spend money on. And if you look at virtually any public polling or news article that talks about swing districts, that's where the money is just really going to pour in. So it's not going to go to the places where we basically know a Republican or a Democrat is going to win. It's going to go to those wobbler districts where maybe just a few more ads could make the difference between a win and a loss for Republicans. And I think the Koch brothers, arguably the biggest beneficiaries of the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision, know exactly how to target their spending so that it is most effective in the parts of the district that could make the biggest difference.
So they did not support Donald Trump in the 2016 election. And Donald Trump did not spend as much money as Hillary Clinton did. And yet he obviously won. And so what does that do to the calculation that money buys elections?
I think that a lot of people are like, well, you know, Donald Trump didn't spend that much. And so you can see that when people are successful, it doesn't have to do with who spent the most money. But Donald Trump got essentially so many in-kind contributions from media networks. So he got for free what most people spend money on. So in essence, we heard from him in the same way that a very expensive campaign would make sure that we heard from the candidate. And I think it's interesting to your question that the Koch brothers have now seen that Donald Trump obviously is the president and that he's doing things that they care about, like tax cuts, and they are very much on the bandwagon.
So maybe they might contribute to his 2020 reelection bid?
I think that they will look and see if they think he's viable, and it will be, as many of their decisions are, a pure business judgment in terms of pumping money into our representative democracy.
Okay, speaking of, some of Trump's closest political advisors are reportedly making millions working for some Trump-allied outside groups. So break this down for us. What's happening here?
So what's happening is that we're seeing the destroying the last vestige of campaign finance, which is that a candidate's campaign is supposed to be a separate entity from groups that we know as like super PACs, those outside groups that spend a lot of money on TV ads and radio ads and increasingly online ads to try and sway our votes. And what we're seeing with respect to the Trump reelection campaign and outside groups is that there's enormous crossover and people and resources. And you're not supposed to do that. They're supposed to be independent. And the kind of sad and interesting part of this is that the Federal Election Commission is deadlocked and is likely to unlikely to take any action. And so I think the Trump campaign and the people profiting from the Trump campaign and the RNC and outside organizations know that. And it's really open season to make money in politics.
Well, give us an example of what this looks like, this cross-pollination.
So what this looks like is someone who is worked like there's a man named Brad Pascal who worked at the digital side of Trump's campaign. And what it looks like is someone like him working for the reelection campaign and then also getting money from the Republican National Committee and also from an outside super PAC. And what it looks like is ads that would come from Trump and ads that would come from the RNC and ads that come from the super PAC all suddenly and mysteriously and coincidentally looking the same.
But isn't it kind of in name only, this non-coordination? Because don't these ads end up doing the same thing anyway? They end up working for the campaign anyway?
I think that's an excellent point, which is kind of two things. One, our definition of independence is actually very, very small, and it allows for things like joint fundraising, which I think surprises a lot of people. The other is that, you know, at what point is it really worthwhile to maintain this fiction of coordination when somehow this happens, for instance, on the local level, where there's an outside group that's supposed to be very much independent from the candidate campaign, but all of a sudden they seem very in tune to what the candidate needs.
I want to talk about another story that's been in the news. The Trump administration has filed a quote-unquote statement of interest in a free speech lawsuit brought by a conservative student group at UC Berkeley. And the students are suing UC officials, accusing them of censorship. And this is involving a speech by Ann Coulter.
Yes. And this is interesting, one, that the Trump administration is deciding to weigh in on this. The Department of Justice is filing a friend of the court brief, is what many people know this as. And they're saying, you know what, we think that these students' free speech rights are harmed because when you tried to get Ann Coulter to campus, you made put so many restrictions on it that it essentially chilled her speech. And you don't do the same thing when a Democratic or a liberal person is coming. And it's interesting to me to see the Department of Justice playing kind of both sides of the First Amendment debate, being very concerned about chilling speech in some instances, but not as concerned in others.
So is it unusual to see this letter from the Justice Department?
It's not completely unheard of, but I would say that the Department of Justice is being more aggressive in terms of finding conservative groups and people and causes and filing these kind of friend of the court briefs. Now, the court doesn't have to consider it other than just reading it. So it doesn't have an enormous amount of persuasive force, depending on the judge. But it's interesting to see how aggressive the Department of Justice is being in some instances in trying to promote for the freedom of speech.
And the student group can then say, look, we have the DOJ on our side.
Oh, I think that this is a boon for the student group. And look, at the very least, the judge has to consider what the Department of Justice is saying. And I think the student group is psychologically and likely legally bolstered by this.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Winter Olympics are right around the corner. Former Olympian, now commentator, Tara Lipinski is here to preview figure skating.
If he wants to skate to a techno short program, that's what he'll do. And he points at the judges and shows a little sass and has fun.
Tara Lipinski and figure skating at the Winter Olympics next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Oh, my goodness. This could do it. And it does. Tara Lipinski upsets the shot for him. With one skater left.
That screaming was 15-year-old figure skater Tara Lipinski 20 years ago as her scores came up at the 1998 Nagano Olympics. She's just seen that she had beaten Michelle Kwan and was likely to win the gold medal, which she did. 4 years ago at Sochi, Lipinski was back at the Winter Olympics, this time as a commentator with Johnny Weir. They were a huge hit, and they'll be back for NBC at the upcoming Olympics in Pyeongchang. And she joins me now. Hi, Tara.
Hi there.
All right, so you were the youngest ever to win a gold. You were an instant star. Was that hard to handle at age 15?
You know, it really wasn't. I think because of my parents. I'm an only child, but very, very close to my parents. My mom had to move away from my dad, which meant I had to move away from my dad when we were training. And he would come in on the weekends here and there. But that was really difficult. But the bond that I created with my mom was really special. And even to this day, she's my best friend. But I think after I won, they were never really sports people. They never pushed me to go into skating. They never, you know, I feel like I was always pushing for me to stay in the sport. But I feel like after I won, they were so proud, but we just never talked about it. It was not a special thing at all. So I feel like they really kept me grounded and made sure that I knew like what I did there was a goal of mine and that I accomplished and that was it.
So your mom is pretty much the opposite of the mom we saw in that movie, Tanya. Tanya Harding's
completely.
Mom.
I was the one begging to skate, and she'd be like, "Are you sure? Like, we can go back to Texas." No, and I'm glad that sort of was my situation, just because looking back, I think to get to that elite level and deal with all the pressure an expectation that's put on you. I think that unless you're really doing it from the heart and really love it and have that sort of obsessive love for it, it's probably the only way you can sustain, at least in my opinion. I don't know how an athlete could go that far and feel pushed into it. That would be my worst nightmare.
Yeah. Well, it did seem like Tonya Harding was really driven. Did you see the movie, by the way?
I did.
And what did you think?
Well, I thought it was, you know, an entertaining movie. I thought the acting was brilliant. I thought Allison Janney was incredible. But, you know, I also lived in the sport during that time, even though I was a baby, 11 years old. I was at that Nationals, not in the same area because they would put us in a different arena. But, you know, I think the one thing I would remember or have people remember even after watching that movie, of course, you know, Tonya had a difficult upbringing. But I think that there are a lot of athletes that come from all walks of life and, you know, have traumatic experiences and difficult relationships. But when it comes down to it, there's something to be said about sportsmanship and playing fair. You know,
you mean, and not kneecapping your opponents or not?
Well, exactly.
Not knowing about it or whatever.
I mean, yeah, it's just, you know, you have to think of the other side of the story as well. Just, you know, what Nancy Kerrigan went through. You know, she was working her entire life as well for that one dream to go to the Olympics and possibly win an Olympic medal. And this happened, you know, weeks before that moment.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, because also we learn in that movie, and if we haven't been following figure skating, that Tonya Harding was able to land a triple axel that still very few women are able to do. Why is that so difficult?
So difficult. Right now we have a skater from the U.S., Mariah Nagasu, who can do it, and it's brilliant. But it's because you're taking an extra half turn. So instead of like a normal triple jump with three revolutions, it's three and a half. And you take off going forward instead of taking off going backwards. And it just feels like you're jumping into nothing. So I hated it. I tried a few and that was it. Never again.
What happened when you tried them?
Oh, I don't remember exactly, but I just didn't like the feeling of, you know, having to put so much power going off to the front, and then also to not get too technical, but there's a thing called a clean edge or a skid on a triple axel. And I had a clean edge, which is almost impossible to do a triple axel off of. And you needed a kind of like a skid, which I'm getting technical. But anyway, there's a lot of reasons why that jump is extremely difficult.
Yeah. And I'm wondering just in general how skating has changed. You know, what is it like now? Is it more athletic? Is it more showmanship? How has it changed in the last couple of decades?
I think the sport is always trying to balance itself out because, you know, there's no clock, there's no finish line in figure skating. It is scored half artistic and half technical. So you have that athleticism and artistry that needs to be combined. And I think everyone has their own view of what that looks like. So that's why sometimes the sport can be a little bit subjective and political at times. But over the years, it's just natural that the sport's evolving technically, especially in the men's event. You have Nathan Chen from the U.S. who is, you know, he's called the Quad King because he's practically revolutionized skating in the United States for men, doing so many quadruple jumps in one program, five or six of them. And if you look back to 2010 Olympics, those Olympics were won without a quad. And even in the ladies event, the Russians are really quite strong and are dominating the sport right now. And it's because technically they've really pushed the bar up.
Well, there has been a doping scandal with the Russians. Do you think that's affected the ice skaters?
Well, I mean, I'm so glad that this was all sort of brought to light because the Olympics is a sacred event and athletes spend their entire lives to play in this moment, and it must be fair. So thank goodness for that. But the athletes that are proven clean are still going to the Olympics, but they won't have, you know, team jackets. They won't hear their anthem, or if they win, the Russian flag will be raised. But I think that it's great that the athletes from Russia that are clean and have worked their whole lives as well for this moment are able to go and you know, enjoy their Olympic experience.
Let's talk about figure skating and the stars that come out of it. We haven't really had a household name like a Tonya Harding or Nancy Kerrigan or Michelle Kwan or Christy Yamaguchi. There hasn't been a big breakout star in a long time. Why?
You know, I think the popularity of the sport isn't the same, and I think that's one of the reasons why. And I think it goes back to right now, skating is hugely popular in Russia and in Japan, and they had major stars over the last decade. And you go to a show over there, and it's filled to the rafters. And here, it's a little bit different. And I think it's like you said, we're missing that female star. And I really do think, it, not to get too technical again, but the way that, say, the Russian Federation had judged skaters in lower levels, they really rewarded risk for many years. So, like, the girl could try a very difficult jump and fall, but they would still score it. So she wasn't afraid to take that risk, if that makes sense, where it was slightly different in the United States. And just recently, those rules were changed. And I think that's because they want to keep up with these other countries that are pushing the bar technically. In the men's event, you have Nathan Chen, and I think it's the first time in a long time that you have someone who is just this brilliant technician and really cool kid that, you know, is trying for a gold medal in these Olympic Games. And I think it will be exciting competition.
Okay, so aside from Nathan Chen, who should we be looking out for?
Well, Nathan Chen obviously is probably the star of skating going into these games, and most likely, you know, the one that could win a gold for the U.S. But in the ladies' event, we may not see them on the podium, but I think Mirai Nagasu is a story that is really incredible, just at the fact that she was left off the Olympic team 4 years ago and replaced by Ashley Wagner. And she was so devastated by that moment that she spent these last 4 years working so hard, and she's been on such a mission to improve, and she has, and she's added the very difficult triple axel and has made it really a jump of her own. She does it as well as anyone else I've seen. And
is she going to do it in the Olympics, do you think?
Yes, I think she will, and she could be the only one trying it there at the Olympics, so that's exciting. So I would really watch out for her, because this is her moment. She's waited these last 4 years when she sort of felt that everyone kind of left her to the wayside, and she's finally made her way back, and I'm hoping she'll shine.
And there are changes now in the way skaters are scored. Is that what you meant by rewarding risk more?
Well, there's an overall judging system that has changed over the years. In the past, it was 5.9, 6.0 system. Now it's very difficult to understand. But the way that the younger skaters are judged can be different in each country. But once you get to a certain level, then obviously there's one judging system. And for a viewer and an audience member, I think it's very difficult to understand. You know, you get a point of, you know, 100.1. You know, and you're like, what is that? You know, whereas before it was very easy. It went up to 6.0.
Yeah.
But it's a step in the right direction for skating. Just, I mean, the judging scandal in 2002, I think everyone knew that there was some changes that needed to be made. And it still leaves room for judges, when it comes to personal taste, to be able to add points here or there. But at the end of the day, every single element is accounted for. So every step a skater takes essentially is being scored. Whereas in the past, when I skated, it was just an overall view of how you did.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that it's called the ladies figure skating, not women's, right?
I mean, I think you can call it whatever you want. Some on the Grand Prix, it's the ladies' event.
But it made me wonder if the image has sort of opened up a little bit since the Tonya Harding days. You know, she was penalized for not looking the part. And I'm wondering if there's a kind of a looser interpretation for women these days.
Like I said, I was 11. So, you know, if things could have been a bit different. I mean, I came 4 years later and I never experienced anything like that. You know, I picked my own music. At 13, I went to the World Championships and skated to the soundtrack from Speed because I saw the movie and I thought it was really cool. And my coaches and everyone was like, what are you doing? Like, everyone's skating to classical music. But I decided to go with that. Most skaters, I think, nowadays are able to really be who they are, pick their own music, pick their own image. You look at someone like Adam Rippon, he chooses his music, and if he wants to skate to a techno short program, that's what he'll do. And he points at the judges and shows a little sass and has fun. So the sport is definitely different than depicted in that movie in 2018.
We'll talk a little bit more about Adam Rippon. He's older, he's 28, and also openly gay. And is that a big deal for figure skating?
You know, I think it's great that Adam's able to own who he is, own his amazing personality, his incredible style of skating, and he's a great technician. He does a quad lutz. But again, I think when it comes down to it, it's part of who he is. And when people say it's a big deal, I never understand that. I mean, my best friend is Johnny Weir. So I'm just like, it's part of who you are. You know, I mean, we live in 2018.
So how did you and Johnny Weir end up, you know, getting together and becoming commentators? And were you surprised at how popular you became at Sochi?
Well, we never knew that was going to happen. You know, I feel so lucky that we had this friendship that was formed during those games, because I knew of Johnny, but, you know, respected his skating, but never really had a friendship with him, didn't know him well or spend time with him. And then when we joined up in 2013, there was just this instant connection. And as cheesy as it sounds, it is just this friendship and this bond that's really strong, that I think not only makes it more fun for the viewer, but, you know, for the both of us, we couldn't imagine doing it without each other. And I know what he's thinking. He knows what I'm thinking. I can finish his sentence. But yeah, we really didn't know what was happening in Sochi. We just realized we might be doing a good job. We just didn't want to get fired. It was our first Olympics. So we just were like, let's fly under the radar.
Okay, so now everyone's going to be looking at you saying, hey, you guys were so great last time around. You better deliver this time around. Do you feeling the pressure?
I mean, we've been doing it for the last 4 years. Skating is on all the time, even though, you know, the public usually tunes in for an Olympic Games. But, you know, we're ready, we're excited, and we've been waiting for this moment for so long. So we just can't wait to get there.
Okay, we can't wait to hear what you have to say. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, of course. Thank you.
That's Tara Lipinski, one half of NBC's famous figure skating coverage team for the Winter Olympics, which begin February 9th. Coming up, the best documentaries at Sundance. Our own Matt Holzman will tell us. And tell us what it was like to be a judge, right, Matt?
It was very judgy.
Don't be judgy. That's coming up next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and I am honored to be in the presence of KCRW's Matt Holzman, back in our studios after spending, a couple of months in Park City?
That's what it feels like.
That's what it feels like for us, too. Matt was a juror for the documentary competition at Sundance this year, and you are back to tell us about the winners.
I will tell you about the winners. I will say just about film festivals in general, though. It's a little like that metaphor of the blind people who encounter an elephant for the first time. Your experience is not the experience. It's just your experience. So mine was a very particular experience because I was a juror for the first time ever, and it was fascinating experience.
So you're like grabbing the tusks, really, of that elephant.
Well, you know, the thing is, when you are a juror in the documentary competition, well, there's two things. One is, you take it very seriously because a prize at Sundance can mean a lot for the director and for the life of a film. And in the documentary category, the films are about very serious topics often. And so it's a question of like, should we give an award to this film? Because that means more people will know about the fact that the LAPD is still using quotas and it's affecting the communities of color. Or do we give it to this award? Because that means that we'll know more about the Yazidis and the experience they've had under the boot of ISIS. So it's not just like I'm giving an award to a film for its incredible creative achievement, but it's also like the topic and what effect that will have on people seeing the film.
And both of those were actual movies you're talking about.
They were, absolutely. And I'll say the other thing is that in the documentary, I kept joking to everybody that the documentary competition at Sundance should be sponsored by Kleenex, because you spend so much time crying in the best possible way. Obviously, it's about the devastation. It's man's inhumanity to man. Mm-hmm. And it's also like how the heights that humans can reach, right? But on both ends of the spectrum, you spend a lot of time crying. By the end of the festival, I just thought, no more tears. I have none left.
Okay. Well, the grand prize winner for the U.S. competition is a movie called Kailash.
Right, who is the name of a Nobel Prize winner who has spent his career trying to end child slavery throughout the world.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And it's like a film. What's interesting
because container ship of Kleenex right there.
Very true. But this is a movie that has used the tropes of a thriller and a mystery to keep you very engaged in a topic that otherwise you just think, oh, God, it's so painful. And it is painful. But it's a kind of a rip-roaring film, and people were really just like in it.
And that won the overall biggest prize.
Exactly, the Grand Jury Prize.
Okay. So some other movies that you liked.
Probably two of my other favorites of the 16 in the category. One was called Minding the Gap. And this is a film that's very subversive because you think it's kind of just about one thing, but it ends up being very much about another. It's about a group of friends who are a bunch of skateboarders in an industrial town in Illinois. And it's very sweet. And there's a lot of film of them skating when they're young and, you know, being wacky. But as the film unfolds, you start to realize that each one of these characters has experienced some version of really dramatic domestic violence, that they've been the subject of it or they've witnessed it, and that they are continuing, at least one of the characters is continuing to perpetrate it. Mm. But it's done in such a kind of a quiet and wonderful way, and there's all this beautiful skate footage, and all the characters are like, you want to hug each and every one of them. It's one of those movies that leaves you really just kind of emotionally spent, but also really thinking about your life and other people's lives and what you know about them and what you don't know about them. So it's just a beautiful movie.
And why is it called Minding the Gap?
You know what? I have no idea. And I wish I had asked the director because I saw him there and I absolutely have no idea.
Because I think of the British tube.
Me too.
I hear that.
Me too. We had a discussion about that and I never got an answer to it. I'll get back to you on that.
All right, good. But it won a prize.
It won, basically it won an award for its freshness. It was just a movie that just popped with life and we all just loved it.
Okay. What else did you love?
Well, probably one of my favorite movies. I love the kind of poetic mode of documentary, the non-polemic, non-didactic, non-expository movies that just kind of unravel. And this movie called Hale County This Morning, This Evening is about a group of people in a small southern town. And it's kind of about the South. But it's just completely non-narrative and it's completely... It speaks completely to your heart and not to your head. You feel like at the end of this movie, you know all these characters. And these are African-American, very poor, working class people who you do feel like if I was to have met them in the hallway, I would be like, oh, I know you. I absolutely know you. And it says so, like it literally says nothing. And yet what is actually communicating is just huge. And it is so beautifully made. And the filmmaker is a first-time filmmaker, a guy who was teaching and coaching basketball down there. And he was a photographer. And he decided he was going to make this movie. Mm. And he's going to have quite a career. I can't wait to see what he does next.
Hale County This Morning, This Evening.
That's right.
It's interesting that these two that you just mentioned aren't really about social justice issues in all caps. They are something a little more subtle.
Well, they're about the personal part of social justice, right? Because Hale County is really talking about the effects of poverty on people. Minding the Gap is really talking about domestic violence. Mm-hmm. But it does it in such a kind of a personal...
A non-didactic way.
And also, it's not macro. It's completely micro. And in that way, you really get... It isn't like reading a headline, right? It's like you feel it rather than understand it.
There was a movie in competition, I don't know if it won, about Mr. Rogers, which I was intrigued
Not
by.
In competition. Morgan Neville, who won the Academy Award for 20 Feet from Stardom, has this biopic about Fred Rogers. And this movie, first of all, let me just say, Kleenex, because the tears that were shed. And everybody was wondering, why were we crying so much? Well, first of all, he's a remarkable character. But there is something about his kindness that reminds you of what you missed in your childhood. Someone saying, looking you in the eye and telling you, you're good just as you are. So that in and of itself is just, you know, I'm going to start crying right now. But then in the context of the current social and political environment, there really is a sense of what has been lost. This idea of kindness towards one another. And I will tell you that I know a couple of people who really did not know who Fred Rogers was because they don't come from this country. One woman who actually the producer of Minding the Gap, who's like, I knew who he was, but I never watched the show and I really don't know that much about him. And then another guy who was not from this country. And I said, well, what did you think? And they said, well, I cried the whole way through. And I thought, wow, so it wasn't just about my personal recollection of being a child and what I missed in being a child. It's about this bigger idea of kindness and how there is a sense that, you know, we that's just something we don't have anymore. Mm-hmm. And he's a fascinating character, and what an absolutely revolutionary he was.
I'm glad to know that he wasn't a horrible man when the cameras were turned off.
I was waiting for that turn in the movie, and Thank God it never came.
Thank God. Okay, there's still some hope left.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also, I just have to note that what he did was talk to children like they were human beings and not trying to sell them stuff. And
about the most difficult issues happening in the world today, and he did it very directly, and he did it many, many, many years before anyone would have thought of doing it. Incredible character.
All right. Yeah. Well, I can't wait to see that and all the other movies that you have
see them all.
Highlighted when they come out to theaters. Thank you, Matt Holzman.
You're welcome.
And thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.